Welcome. You're listening to the Mac Observer's Background Mode. This is your host, John Martellaro. And this week, my guest is editor-in-chief of Six Colors, Jason Snell. Jason, good afternoon.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Hey, thanks for joining me on the show. You are, perhaps in my mind anyway, one of the best known of all the Apple technical journalists, having been the former editorial director of Macworld. And we all really love your writing and appreciate what you've done all throughout the years.
That's very kind. Thank you.
So how did you get your start in journalism? Is that, first of all, when you were younger, did you even think that you were going to be a journalist?
Yeah, I did. I was fascinated by media and creating things. When I was a kid, I would like go out on the back porch in a rainstorm and pretend that I was like doing a live TV stand-up reporting on the weather. I mean, seriously, I had, on my first computer that I had, I would occasionally listen to baseball games, and I would just, not even in a program, just sort of like, I would clear the screen and I could move around with the cursor keys, the arrow keys, and I could, and I would make like a scoreboard and update it with like the line score of the baseball game and balls and strikes.
Were you a Vin Scully follower?
I grew up in Northern California, so I could only hear Vin Scully late at night, when it would bleed in, all the way to Northern California from LA. But, I think that if you had looked at what I was interested in as a kid, I think this shouldn't have been a surprise, although, it depends on your perception of me, because, I was also interested in computer stuff, right? So media and computer stuff, I am mixing those two things. That would seem to be a pretty straight, forward thing. I did, you know, I'd go back to a high school reunion and I would have people say, you know, some of them would be like, oh yeah, sure, of course. And other people would be like, oh, I thought you'd just do computers or something like that. And I'd be like, well, no, I had this other thing too. Like, I was on the radio station and, you know, you remember me from like reading the announcements in the morning, my junior year in high school. Right. And they're like, oh yeah, that too. Right. So I think that there's a straight line. Some people who observed me may have a different opinion, but in my mind, it's not surprising at all, really.
Well, I want to ask you a question I ask most of my guests, and that is, was there a particular influence? Many of my guests report that their parents brought an Apple II home or a Mac home from school, or they had a particularly influential teacher. I mean, what was the trigger point there that started that journalism fascination?
Well, the media stuff, I don't know if I could even tell you. My parents, you know, my mom was a nurse, my dad was a dentist.
So well, that'll do it. That'll do it.
It wasn't from them at all.
No, but that'll do the technical part. Yeah.
On the computer side, I will say, so my best friend in elementary school, his dad was an elementary school teacher, and they were, you know, they were into computers. His dad, a guy named Chuck Holland, was incredibly into computers. And so he got them into our elementary school, and he had them at home, and I would go over to my friend's house, and we would play on the, you know, first it was a Commodore PET, and then it was an Apple II Plus, and he took us to the West Coast Computer Fair one year, which is like a 3-hour drive from where I grew up in the mountains in Northern California. So, you know, I'm going to give full credit to Chuck Holland for getting me into computer stuff. And then on the media side, yeah, I don't even know. I was always fascinated by it from the beginning. I was fascinated at how computers could change how you did like creation and transmission of media. That was a thing that I figured out like in elementary school, and certainly in high school. I ran a computer bulletin board in my bedroom when I was in high school, and then got to college, and I did an internet short story magazine because I was like, you know, look what we could do. We could publish things on the internet.
Is that Intertext?
That was Intertext, right. So that was always kind of there. I'm not sure if I have a particular influence. I mean, there were great teachers that I had, especially I took a video class in high school for 3 years. Basically, I took it because we were making movies and doing a, you know, news broadcast, and I was learning how to edit and shoot stuff. And that teacher was great. But I kind of brought my own enthusiasm with me there. So I think it was a pretty straightforward just a passion for me. The computer stuff I could definitely point to, but the other one, it just was always, I mean, when I was in kindergarten, a film crew, or like a TV news crew, came in to just shoot, I think basically B-roll of us in our classroom. And I remember being like, I remember that. I remember very few specific events from kindergarten, but I remember that. So it obviously fascinated me from the beginning.
Did you think you'd want to be in front of the camera more in terms of being like a news anchor or something?
So when I went to journalism school at UC Berkeley, which in 92, when I graduated from college, the economy wasn't very good. And most of my colleagues who were graduating from UC San Diego, who worked at the college newspaper, again, extending this on, I worked at the college newspaper. I ended up as the editor in chief of my college newspaper at UCSD. The jobs weren't very good. Like, I had a friend who was working for local weekly, and I decided basically to like put it off and see if I could get, you know, more experience and a better job, and the economy could be better in a couple of years. So I went to grad school for journalism. And so that helped. And that's where I made connections and things like that. So, you know, in the end, that's where I ended up.
Connections. Did one of your connections help you get the intern job at MacUser?
Oh yeah, that's exactly how it happened. I forget where I was going with the grad school angle, but anyway, yeah, I was a teaching assistant because I learned everything there was to know about like desktop publishing and stuff when I was in college, because we did our entire college newspaper digitally. There was a,
you know, Tanya Yangs did that exactly same sort of story.
So they did a desktop. Excuse me. They did a desktop publishing class at the Graduate School of Journalism, and I needed a teaching assistant job. And the person who was teaching that class was a senior editor at MacUser, and that is how I got that job. So because I bugged her and said, you need a summer intern, and they didn't even have an internship program, but I got my internship, and that led to my career, essentially. So that was a good move. But to bring it back around, I remember now, we talked about TV, you were asking. Mm-hmm. One of the things I did in journalism school was I wanted to find out if I wanted to do TV. And so I took a year and I did TV, and we did, you know, short form stuff, and we did TV interviews, and we did like big magazine pieces. And, you know, you were sort of expected to go on to the second year and do a documentary. And I found, as much as TV has always fascinated me, and journalism has always fascinated me, I found TV journalism incredibly unfulfilling, because I discovered that after having spent all this time at my college paper, where you can call somebody up or catch somebody in their office and ask them a question and they give you an answer, or they today, you know, maybe they send you an email, but you can do that and you can build a story and you can tell the story of what's going on and communicate to people what is happening. In TV news, it's all about what pictures you can show and who's available for you to get video of. And if it's somebody who's not very good and doesn't have anything interesting to say, it doesn't matter. You build your story around them because they're the one that you can get on video. And that really well-spoken person who you can get on the phone, but you can't actually go out and talk to them with your film crew, doesn't get in the story. And I realized very quickly that I think I could have had a career doing that. And I just wasn't interested. I found it was fortunate. One of the things I always say, the two things that I got out of journalism school were one, making the connections that led me into tech journalism, and two, learning that I didn't want to do TV news.
When you arrived at MacUser, were you really deep on the Mac at the point where you were writing technical articles, or was it just sort of the beginning of digging into the Mac for print journalism?
I was interested in it. You know, in those days, it's hard for people who are younger to remember, but you know, if you can imagine or even know, if you can imagine, the only source of information you got about what was going on with Apple was a magazine that came every month. That was basically the situation back then.
And Mac Week, not, of course.
Yeah, well, if you were very lucky to get Mac Week in your educational institution or your company, you might have it. But yeah, Almost nobody got Mac Week. So you'd get Mac World or Mac User, and that was it. So I was starting in college. Like I said, we did desktop publishing of the entire newspaper. When I went to college, I had an Apple II. But when I started on the college paper, everybody had Macs. They had just gotten Macs. They had PageMaker. They had big full page displays. We had 11x17 image setter that we could output the entire tabloid sized, an entire tabloid page of the paper on it, and just cut it out and put it down. And that was pretty amazing. And I learned very quickly how to do all of that stuff on the technical side. And that's how I kind of insinuated my way into the college paper. But that also made me just hopelessly in love with the Mac at that point. So I bought, I dug into my college fund, basically stole from myself and bought a Mac my sophomore year in college. Cause I,
what was
I
your first Mac?
There's a Mac SE, the SE right when it was about to be replaced by the Classic. And so it was discounted and they were really expensive back then. So, that was the one that I got and I loved it. And so I came to Mac User with a great enthusiasm for the Mac. And I had been the person, not only was I the editor in chief of my college paper, but yeah, I was the one who bought the phone net local talk adapters on at Mac Warehouse and ran phone cables across the office at the paper so that you could print to the printer from any computer instead of just the one, and so that you could transfer your files across the network instead of putting them on a floppy. These were innovations.
I remember
right?
those days. You felt like you were some sort of small god, and everybody was in awe, right?
So I was chief/ IT director. Yeah, it was a little bit of both. It was a weird combo. But so I was interested in it. I downloaded System 7 on all the floppies and did all of that. I didn't come to it from a computer science background or anything, but I was very much enthusiastic with the tech. And so that was what I brought. I had to learn a lot, but I definitely brought the sort of like technical enthusiast frame of mind. I poured over my issues of Mac User. I was a Mac User subscriber.
Me too.
That was what I did. And so when I went there, that was great because I had been indoctrinated by them for several years at that point.
So with great grace and humor in your bio, you talk about this incredible mix-up that, with a grin, that led to you being the editorial director at IDG Publishing and Macworld.
Well, it's not much of a mix-up. It just shows you the power of perseverance. If you hang around long enough and everybody else is gone, you are the most senior person. And apparently they put you in charge at that point. I mean, I went through at Mac User. I was an intern. Then I was a news editor. And I was like our first, I think, dedicated online editor, which was back in the day when online meant like CompuServe more than it meant the internet. Mm-hmm. It was trying to drag that magazine into the internet, and then finally we got a website and all of that. And then Mac User and Macworld merged in 97, which was sort of the low point of Apple, where it was about to go out of business, and the publishers decided they would fold those magazines together so that they could reduce their losses, essentially, which was a huge mistake. And if 6 months later they would have realized it was a giant mistake to do that. And all they really did was open the door for Mac Addict to become a strong number two, when they probably could have stomped Mac Addict if they had continued publishing Mac User and Macworld separately. So it was a good move for future that the number one and number two basically decided to kill themselves and form a new number one and left Mac Addict as number two. Anyway, so I went to the new Macworld and, you know, hung around there. And what happened was there was a huge amount of turnover because there was turmoil. Mac User people were chosen to move to Macworld, but Macworld people were basically, half of them were laid off and the others were told to stay. And so they weren't happy. They couldn't choose, you know, severance or something like that. They had to stay. And they were unhappy. So most of them looked for new jobs. So in the end, what happened was most of the people who from that half of the staff at Macworld left, and who was left to do the magazine. And the answer was, you know, a few of us from Mac User were really there to do the magazine, and that included me. So I very rapidly went from having never, you know, been involved in magazine features to being the features editor. And then, you know, so it basically a series of events where I stepped up and said, sure, I'll do that. That led to me being. Oh, that was in the like late 90s. 97 is when the merger happened. Mm-hmm. And so through the late 90s into the early 2000s. And then, you know, I think I was basically the number two on the publication by like 2002. And then editor in chief when my boss got kind of kicked up to be the president of Macworld in 2003, maybe something like that. That was when I became editor in chief, somewhere around in there. It was kind of a continuum. It's hard for me to like point at a date. So I just kind of rose through the ranks from intern all the way up to editorial director. It sounds funny, but that's how it happened.
So the internet went public around 96 or so. in the early days, it must have felt like you were off and running for your for the big stage of your career, right?
You know, I did an internet magazine in 91, and I did I had a blog in 95. The magazine didn't, right? And that was the challenge, was dragging it in. One of the things I say this a lot when I talk about the old days, but I want to say it again, is I went to work at a magazine because that those were the only jobs that existed that would pay you to do media. But I left college with, you know, having published things on the internet, magazines on the internet, like, and posting, you know, I had a mailing list. We had, we were posting on Usenet. And then, while I was in grad school, I was publishing things on the web, which had just started. And I had a blog in 95 when I had just started at Mac User not too long before. And so the contrast was pretty dramatic that we were doing that. And yet in my day job, I was still trying to drag people to digital media, and we were just doing a lot of print. That's where the money was. So over the course of the next, whatever, 10, 15 years, that was the story, right? Was trying to change a culture that, and it's not like the culture of Mac User or Mac World. It's changing the culture of print publishing, of journalism, of the media business, and everybody was doing it at their own organizations to think more about digital and about moving faster and about thinking of going to the web and then thinking about going to the web first. And it took a long time. It took a long time and a lot of effort to get there.
It did. It did. Well, what a story. I think it's a good time to take a break right now. When we come back, I want to chat with you about Six Colors and a lot of Apple technology stuff. So we'll be back in 60 seconds, folks. Stay with us. I'm talking with Jason Snow.
Hello there, all you fabulous Background Mode listeners. I'm Kelly Gamont with the Mac Observer, and I just want to say a few words about how you can support all the things we do. If you're thinking about buying something from Apple, Amazon, or Mac Mall, just go to the Mac Observer's homepage, where we have a section called Support TMO. Or you can just enter macobserver.com/Apple Store, all one word, and that will take you to our special page for Apple and our other affiliates. If you make a purchase from one of our partners this way, the Mac Observer receives a small compensation for sending business their direction. Pretty cool, right? And you don't pay a penny more. This small fee from our affiliates helps us continue to bring you TMO's daily news, reviews, tips, how-tos, and podcasts like this one. So the next time you're thinking about an online purchase, come to TMO's homepage and support the Mac Observer. Thanks. Back to you, John.
Thanks, Kelly. Chatting with Jason Snell, the editor-in-chief of Six Colors. Wow, what a great name, by the way. I love that name. Tell us how you arrived at that name, Six Colors.
You know, I was going out on my own and I wanted to do a site, and I wanted it to be something that was that reflected my interest in covering Apple and my history covering Apple, but didn't have Apple in the name. Didn't have I something in the name. I wanted it to be, I had a list, right? I wanted it to be, I learned from doing TV, that's T-E-E-V-E-E, which was my blog in the 90s, that I wanted words that were spelled the way words were spelled and not ones that you had to spell out. I wanted a .com because TV was a .org and a .net, but we couldn't get the .com. So I had a whole list, and I came up with, I wish I could find the file. I came up with like 15 names that I thought of, but the one that I liked the best was Six Colors, because it was the famous when Steve Jobs went back to Apple, he asked why so many talented people had stayed when it was a sinking ship, and people would tell him, you know, that they still bled six colors, the rainbow logo, the original rainbow logo of Apple. And I thought that was an interesting story, and it was a reference that people wouldn't need to get, but it was a reference to a history with Apple and caring about Apple and Apple products. And so, and it, you know, six colors, you can spell those words. Mm-hmm. And it turns out that sixcolors.com was like registered, but it was for sale and not being used. It was parked. There was no other Six Colors anything. And for a couple $1,000s, which at the time I really kind of bit my fingernails about, but I'm very happy I did it. It gave me a name. That was always my number one. And I feel incredibly fortunate that it worked out, because I did have a bunch of others too, but I was fortunate to find something. I just assume everything on the internet has been done before and is taken, but that was a case where I was able to get it.
That was actually quite brilliant. I assume you have one of the little Apple six color pins.
I don't know if I have a pin. I have a bunch of Rainbow Apple things, and I've collected some more over the years since turning Six Colors especially. But I just wanted something that, you know, didn't mean anything, but had meaning if you looked deeper, and, you know, it doesn't need to mean anything.
It's perfect.
And that was what I was going for. So I was very happy, because I really didn't think it would be as easy as it turned out to be. I really was prepared for having to go through a bunch of names to even find anything that was usable.
Well, in January, you published a great article, I thought, at Six Colors. Apple in 2016, the Six Colors Report Card. I was blown away by that. The reason is because it looked like it was a lot of work to collate the consensus of a lot of different contributors. And in that regard, it had a lot of credibility because of the scope of all the people who contributed to that article. So I really liked it, and I recommend it to all the readers and listeners. Were you surprised by the consensus of the contributors? Because I think everybody seemed to kind of feel this little angst at the end of 2016.
No, I mean, that's the funny thing about it. I mean, this was Koi Vin, the designer, suggested this to me like 2 years ago. He said, this is a good idea, but I don't want to do it. Do you want to do it? And I said, yeah, I'll do that. And so this is the second year of doing it. And I wasn't surprised. I feel like it's valuable for a couple of things. One is to get to take the temperature kind of broadly about how people are feeling. And I don't think in general, since these are all largely people who write and speak about Apple stuff and maybe also develop software, they are when you say that, you know, the buzz in the community is this, oftentimes it's because these sorts of people have absorbed that or are kind of helping create it. And so on that level, I don't think you're going to get surprises. I think the value of it is to quantify that in a way, to be able now to compare it to the mood the year before, and to get the details, because I ask them all to say if they want to add some words about their feelings in the matter. And it is an effort to put that project together. I took a vacation beginning of January, and one of the things I had to do was bring this work with me. And the only work I did on that vacation was try to collate a lot of the answers, because there were so many people were so giving in terms of how many words they wrote that it was kind of overwhelming. But I feel like it's good to get that down and say, this is what, you know, as of the end of 2016, this is sort of what three dozen people who do, you know, who are high profile commenters on Apple stuff, how they feel the company's doing, what progress they've made, where they've receded over the course of a year.
When you finally published the report card, did you find that you were in total agreement, or were there some areas where you thought your original feelings were different?
So I didn't vote in it for that reason. I think I agree with it in large part. I mean, everybody, there were votes all over the place for all of them. So yeah, there are probably some places where I feel more strongly than others about, you know, either positively or negatively. And a lot of the extreme opinions wash out when you average out a score over 36 votes, a lot washes out. But so, yeah, I mean, I'm sure there are areas where I would say that I thought that was too harsh, or I think that was not harsh enough. But yeah, I think it's a useful tool to get it down and look at it. And the only thing that surprised me, honestly, and it shouldn't surprise me, is that I got some feedback from people saying basically like, I can't believe you're so negative to me. And I'm like, well, I didn't actually have an opinion in this. This is 36 different people with their own opinions, some of which are positive and some of which are negative. So, yeah. You know, people are going to do that. But I think it's useful to quantify it, right? Because it's so easy to say, oh, you know, the buzz is that Apple is not doing a great job with the Mac. And you can say that, but it's very hard to point to the buzz, right? You can't really do that. But with this article, you can say, look, at the end of the year, this guy talked to 36 prominent Apple watchers, right, and they all said that the Mac, you know, pretty much the average was very bad. It was a recession from the previous year. And look at this, you know, kind of menu of comments that people made about it. At least it gives you something to point at and say, you know, people were restless in 2016 about the Mac.
They were. And one of the things I found was that on January, what was it, 31st, when Apple did the earnings report for Q1, the Mac numbers looked pretty good in terms of revenue, and not so much of a decrease as the iPad, more of like a 1% increase in units. And a healthy $7.2 billion in revenue did. That really affected my outlook and said, well, look, Apple must have made some good choices there, or they must have sold a whole lot of MacBook Pros with Touch Bar in late 2016 yep. to make up for it. Did that earnings report sort of buoy you up like it did me?
I don't know. I mean, I think that you could argue both sides. I think the average selling prices went up, and that suggests that they sold a lot of MacBook Pros, which is unsurprising since it was the new product in the market. And so their revenue went up substantially. But I'm not sure that it's a solution. Like, I don't think people are worried that the Mac is going to belly flop. I think people are more just frustrated at some of the decisions Apple's making and are concerned that that might affect the company over time. Also, I think a lot of the discomfort that people feel about the Mac is concentrated in some very particular areas that
like
are
the Mac Pro.
That are high-end, yeah, and prominent mm-hmm. in a way, but are probably not particularly prominent in terms of sales. And that's a place where a community concern may not actually reflect. You know, it may be a distortion of reality because we have too many people in that area, and it's not really representative of the overall thing. And what I keep saying is they're not wrong to be frustrated. The people who feel that Apple is not serving them as high-end users, as professional users, that's not an invalid feeling at all, but it may be irrelevant to Apple's decision making or to the health of the Mac line as a whole. The flip side would be maybe it's not. Maybe Apple has kind of lost the plot on the Mac, and they need to. I mean, there
was
no
that
desktop
story
Macs
at Bloomberg
announced
by
in 2016.
Mark, so. By Mark Gurman, remember that? I think it was in early December where he talked about some disarray and some loss of talent, and then maybe Tim wasn't paying.
Maybe.
Enough tension.
So I think it's a long story. I don't think there's going to be a big bump up or down. I think it's really about, looking at the results over time and looking at what Apple does. I'm fairly positive. I don't think the Mac, I think Apple's making decisions that are probably going to be okay. They may frustrate some people. I don't think that people being frustrated doesn't necessarily mean that they're the wrong business decisions. They might be the right ones. And that's terrible to tell somebody like, you are no longer important to this company that you care about who makes tools that you use. That's awful, right? But it doesn't necessarily mean that it's wrong. Now, it may be wrong, but it might not be.
Do you think there's a case to be made in addition for Apple to have a halo machine, a top-end machine that really doesn't have a lot of sales, but inspires people?
Yeah, there is a case. I think there's a strong case. I think that the Mac Pro would have been discontinued if they weren't planning on doing a new one. I think the reason that they're keeping the old Mac Pro in the line is probably because there's something else that they're working on and they're not ready yet. So they're just letting it sit there because otherwise it's pretty embarrassing and kind of inexplicable why it's
especially
just sitting
next to the cinema display.
So, I think so. I think Apple is big enough and that the Mac is a big enough category that you should create. If you're Apple, you should create some products that are either flexible or are, things you can point to and say, here is the product for people at the absolute high end. Right. I think those are the roles of the Mac Mini and the Mac Pro is to just sort of like round out the line. And just because they're not the big hits doesn't mean that they shouldn't exist.
Right. I mean, if we know how to build the very best, it's like racing cars. If we know how to build the very, very best, you can bet that that's folded into our lower end machines too. So that's a good case to be made. All right, so let's move on to the iPad. You also published, this time at Macworld, a very interesting article I saw just recently, Reasons to be Optimistic About the iPad's Future. Tell me about that article and what you're thinking there.
Where it started, honestly, was the last section of that article, which is all of this discussion about the iPad. Oh, the sales are down. Well, but they still sell twice as many as they do Macs. Lots of conversation out there on websites, in podcasts about this issue. And I keep coming back to this one thought, which is the future is not the smartphone for work. Because you could argue smartphone is the answer to all of these questions. It's not Mac versus iPad. It's the smartphone. But screen size is the thing I keep coming back to. Mm-hmm, and so that's what I wrote about in the column, which is, I don't believe that in 2025, all work will be done on 4-inch screens. Like, it's not going to happen because you need to see more. So either you're going to have like a VR headset or, you know, an augmented reality headset that you put on. I guess that could happen. It seems unlikely because then you're waving your hands in the air and stuff. Or there's going to need to be a piece of glass that you either drive with a keyboard and a mouse or you put your hands on it. And that, you know, maybe that's driven by your smartphone, which is super intelligent. But if you're going to go to the trouble of building that piece of glass, I think more likely it's going to be intelligent and it's going to sync that your cloud data that's also on your smartphone and any other devices you've got, at which point it's a tablet. So what is the, you know, where does this go? And I think the iPad is Apple's answer, which is this is where the smartphone context goes in with larger screens is the iPad. And I feel there, the smartphone is not going to fade away, right? Like the smartphone is now the dominant computing metaphor, dominant computing platform. That is it, the smartphone. The PC is still around. It's not going to go away, but it is kind of an old school thing. It definitely skews older in usership just because, like, you know, young people especially, they all have smartphones and they love them, and touching a screen is second nature to them. So if I look out a few years, there's got to be something that lets you do work, but also feels like what people are familiar with, which is a smartphone. And in my mind, from Apple's perspective, that's the iPad or other things like the iPad. Maybe there's a 27-inch iPad or something like that.
I hope so. Have you looked at the Microsoft Surface Studio? What do you think of that? It's basically a 28-inch iPad.
Yeah, I haven't had my hands on it yet. Well, it's not quite, right? Because it's a PC too.
Right.
But I'm intrigued by the idea of that. So that's where that article started, is really just saying, look, screens alone, I feel like the iPad is going to have a place. It doesn't necessarily mean it's going to completely override the Mac, but I think that the iPad's place is in providing a touch interface that doesn't fit in your pocket, and that there's going to be value and more of it over time in doing that, to do like real work kind of stuff. But Apple has to step up and make the iPad more suitable for real work. I don't think, you know, there are a lot of things it needs to do to broaden the iPad's appeal as a work device. People can use it today to get work done, but it's hard. And you have to jump through hoops. So that was my starting point for writing that piece, is just my optimism is that I feel like there's a place that this product needs to go. And then the other part of it was just my belief that I have written about before, but I wanted to restate it, that if you imagine the Mac or the iPad today, and then you imagine a fantastic large screened computing device in 2025, which platform is more likely to get you there? And I feel like the iPad is more likely. It's a very straight line from here to there for a large screen, futuristic working device. And with the Mac, I feel like Apple would be doing more kind of dumbing down of the Mac, making changes to the Mac that make it less like the Mac. And I think the Mac's asset is that it is the Mac, and that it is familiar, and that it follows these rules that we've had since 1984 for that kind of use. And so, like, the iPad is built to become that device. And if you tried to make the Mac that device, I think it would make the Mac worse in getting there. So that was my other part of the argument, is just like, that's what the iPad is meant to do. The iPad is meant to be the thing that leads to, not today, but the thing that leads to that kind of device in 8 years.
I agree. Do you think along the way, as the screen size gets bigger, we might see a large screen iPad with something that you didn't mention in the article? And that is, I've been told that with a little bit of tweaking, because iOS is a fork of macOS, that iOS could be modified, say with mouse support, to run macOS apps. So imagine a 27-inch iPad that had a window on it, and you were running your Mac apps on the same screen you were running your iOS apps. Could that perhaps be a transition away from the Mac and into the future as you envision it?
I suppose, although I don't think it would ever be a mainstream thing. It reminds me a little bit of like running Classic when OS X started, or when they talked about, you know, blue box and yellow box, mm-hmm. and things like that, like compatibility
they
modes.
Did a great job
running a virtual machine. Mm-hmm. Like I could see maybe something like that existing, but not as a solution as much as a transitional form that would
right.
go away.
Yeah,
you know, Apple added an iBeam cursor to iOS 9. There is now all it would take was them to support Bluetooth pointing devices, and they would only work in text insertion right now, which may be all that you need. They could totally do that today. So they've already kind of broken that one where you have a virtual trackpad on the iPad and on the phone. If you it's 3D touch on the phone, and it's two fingers down on the iPad. So, you know, they've already kind of taken steps there. And there's other, you know, the windowing can be more sophisticated in terms of split screen, or maybe you've got a tabbed view. Maybe you can put multiple apps on the screen at once. I mean, there's things that they would need to do. But yes, I do absolutely expect that Apple is going to make iOS devices that are larger than the 12.9 inch iPad Pro. I think they have to.
I think
there's a market. I think there's a market there, right? I think the Surface Studio, while an interesting product, I mean, I think the thing it says to me is that there is a market for a big iPad, one that's got the Apple Pencil support, mm-hmm. and maybe has to be on a very clever kind of mounting device so that you can move it around, but to run those apps. But the iPad also needs to have a richer software environment to do that, and that's kind of on Apple.
Yep, I agree. I'm with you right there. So in the few minutes we have left, I want to ask you about one more topic, and okay. That's the Apple TV. You host a podcast with Dan Morin called Clockwise. And in episode 175, you talked about Apple acquiring a new manager in the TV Apple TV group, Timothy Twerdahl, who came from Amazon. Mm-hmm. What are your current thoughts about that? Do you think Apple's ramping up finally for a 4K and HDR Apple TV? Do you think just more app focus? What do you think is happening there?
I think Apple's strategy with the Apple TV was very deal focused. And when I look at this, which is they're taking the previous Apple TV manager and having him be in charge of deals, working with Eddie Q on like content deals with TV networks and things. And the new guy is the former leader of the Amazon Fire TV program.
Right.
So what that says to me, and maybe again, I'm wish casting here, but what it says to me is that Apple is recognizing that the Apple TV, for it to be a good product, it needs to be less focused on what deal being a vehicle for their deals and be a better product unto itself. So I would hope that means they will do a lower cost version of it that can better compete with, because the competition is as good as Apple and way cheaper. And that they would do a 4K HDR version, absolutely. And that they would look at, you know, improvements to the software, to the remote, perhaps using iOS devices more as a remote option since everybody's got them, stuff like that. But so I'm hopeful, but it may take some time. They may already be moving in those directions, and that may be why he was hired. But, you know, making a new product takes time. I hope they're continuing to advance the ball on the Apple TV, because it needs more. It needs work. It's not a bad product, but it's being overshadowed
by the Roku, I think.
It has some tough competition.
Yeah.
Well, and the Amazon Fire TV is really great too. I mean, the value is there. And Apple's biggest reason to get an Apple TV is that there are Apple services like, you know, Apple's movie and TV library and things like AirPlay that are just not available on other devices. But that's it. It's this artificial barrier that makes you have to get an Apple product if you want those features. Otherwise, they don't really have a lot to recommend them over the competition.
Well, this has been really great. I want to thank you so much for your insights about Macs and iPads and Apple TV. Folks, I hope you really enjoyed listening to the discussion. Jason, tell the listeners how they can contact you if they wish.
Sure. I am Jay Snell on Twitter, and you can find my writing at sixcolors.com, and my podcasts are at theincomparable.com and relay.fm.
Cool. Thank you so much for being on the show. It was a pleasure.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Folks, I hope you enjoyed the discussion, and we'll see you next week on the Mac Observer's Background Mode.